There is a sutra where a coat makes a prominent role. And it's a coat of a person who has left home and wandered for many, many years and has become quite poor, pauper, struggling along, maybe begging, clothes tattered, no place to sleep but under the trees. But the person was given a coat on leaving home, and one day the person came back home, and someone there said, "But didn't you know that in the coat there was a very expensive jewel?" "No." "Well, it was sewed into the lining. You always had it with you all along." So maybe it's a little silly story, but the moral of the story is that we each have treasure in our lining. I don't know where your lining is. Linings of your heart. And people will go wandering around the world looking for something. Maybe paupers or poor, not knowing of this inner wealth. And yesterday Adrian talked about inner poverty, and the idea of inner wealth. And it's in the teachings of the Buddha, he explicitly referred to things like loving kindness, virtues, as our inner wealth. And he was, you know, very explicit that for monastics who have given up material wealth, their wealth is their loving kindness, is their equanimity, is their the virtue, the ethical integrity that they have inside. And we have these jewels within us that are easily overlooked, and people search for safety, security, happiness, well-being, rewards in the world. And these are all have an important role in our lives. But it's also possible to discover the wealth that's within, a wealth that is portable, and a wealth which maybe has a chance of being a little bit more available or more constant in our lives than the vagaries of what happens in the world. So the paramis, these 10, are beautiful virtues that live within us. And perhaps initially they live in us as potentials. They're seeds of them inside of us. Or maybe they're there, not even as seeds, but maybe they're overlooked. They're there to ready to operate and ready to be a support for us. But we're busy with other things. And in the busyness of other things, other preoccupations and concerns, we don't take time to notice them. We don't appreciate them. And I know that I was very busy, preoccupied for a long time, feeling guilty. Gil is short for guilt, in case you wondered. And so it was, you know, and I became acutely aware of how much I was guilty before, you know, before proven guilty. I don't have to be guilty for anything. I was just guilty. It's kind of, you know, inefficient to be guilty for something. But I became acutely aware of it when I started doing retreats and start seeing what goes up through the mind in a way that I hadn't seen in daily life. I didn't see the patterns of my mind. I didn't see so carefully what was going on. I was maybe involved in the I don't know, the headlines of what was of my mind, but I wasn't hadn't gone to the back pages where, or the back room where the real things were going on. So, in the back room of my mind were all these ideas and policies, beliefs about myself and the world. And so we can live in ideas that we are somehow inadequate, or we don't belong here, or that we're somehow broken, or that we are, or that success and happiness is found in a particular way, that security and safety is found when we have an arsenal of weapons or the equivalent of it or something. And so in that preoccupation of those things, maybe there's not noticing the kind of inner wealth that's available and not an appreciation of its value and its power in our lives. So these 10 paramis, the theme of this retreat, are virtues that live within us, and they are a form of wealth. They're also sometimes in the tradition called beautiful. There's a very interesting teaching. One of the driest teachings in all the Buddhism is what's called the Abhidhamma, sometimes called Buddhist psychology, but it's more like Buddhist categories of mental factors or something. And so it's very, very dry. But they have one thing that is inspiring, that inspired me at least, and that is they'll organize the mental factors, mental qualities that operate for us into different categories. And so there's the unskillful mental qualities or factors, unskillful mental functioning. And I think it's very nice to call things unskillful. It's better than calling them bad or wrong or something. It's unskillful, and so if it's unskillful, you can do something about it. You can get skillful. You can develop a skill. You can understand what to do. It's not so solid. So on one hand, there's the unskillful. And then the other hand, you would think that if there's unskillful faculties of mine, there must be skillful ones. But instead of calling it skillful, the opposite of unskillful is called beautiful. The beautiful factors of the mind, the beautiful qualities of the mind. And here again we see this idea of that there's something beautiful inside. Sometimes the self-effacing nature of Buddhist practice, you know, this idea of not self or not being self-centered or caught up in self-preoccupation, can somehow seem like it negates that there's anything in there that we can value or appreciate. But the opposite is true, that the less we're preoccupied with conceit, preoccupied with self-centeredness, preoccupied with a certain self-centeredness, that it makes room for what's beautiful to shine and to be there and for us to see it and to nourish us and feed us. So these paramis are the beautiful treasures. The first three have more to do with activities, what we do and don't do. And so generosity that Adrian talked about generosity is a quality of heart, but generosity is expressed in what we do in the world, how we are, how a generous attitude, generous behavior, generous words. Generosity is something that is expressed, it's what we do. And here in this list of paramis, the beginning of them has to do with how we live in the world. That how we live in the world is important. And how we live in relationship to other people is important. And the way that this list begins is how we live, that to live with generosity to people around us, to ourselves. And that generosity is a virtue, generosity is a beautiful thing. Generosity cannot be obligatory, then it's not generous. Generosity is a voluntary, it's a quality of heart, it's a beautiful quality that can be there. And what happens if we recognize our generosity? What happens if we appreciate it or value it? Not because we should, but because it's there, because it's a marvelous thing. And what we see, I believe, in at least what I've kind of learned through my practice, but I think we see it, you know, in teachings of the Buddha, that the starting point of our life happens every moment. Every moment is a new beginning. And every moment is a new seeing of this world that we're in. But the source of that seeing, or the reference point for that seeing, can be the inner beauty, the inner treasures that we have here, the inner, we can have a reference point for how to see the world, how to be in the world, how to be, that is this inner sense of well-being or some treasure inside. And if we have a reference point of treasure inside, something important and valuable in our hearts, in our inner life, then we can become the custodian of that beauty, or custodian of that thing of value. And part of the whole enterprise of Buddhism is to become the custodian of our own inner life, of our own heart. No one else can be or should be a custodian of your heart. If you're waiting for your inner life to be all lined up and all wonderful and cozy and wonderful and peaceful, for other people to behave just properly and treat you just the right way, either you might have to wait for a long time, or you'll find that it's not that reliable. People change, and situations change, and people die, and people move, and people get confused and do sometimes hurtful things. All kinds of things can happen. So if we're depending on others to set our right, our inner life, our heart, it's not really such a good idea. But to take on the idea that we are the custodian for our hearts, for our inner life, that we're responsible for what we do, how we are, for caring for this, for having compassion for what's here, for being kind, for discovering what's here and valuing it. And part of what we're trying to do in Buddhist practice is in fact to awaken a vision, a knowledge, an understanding, seeing into ourselves. We find something that's valuable in there, that's precious. And that can have many different things. One of the ones that in early Buddhism was emphasized was a profound sense of peace. And the profound sense of peace was considered to be one of the richest and most valuable places for the heart to rest. Another concept for this was a sense of freedom. This inner life, the heart, was not constricted or bound up, tied up, fettered, but was set free. So the heart could breathe easily, you know, to be able to breathe with ease, and the breath not being held back in any kind of way. There is a sense of deep love and compassion that can dwell inside. Sense of deep happiness that can be inside. There's many different concepts or words for this. Different people might experience it different ways. But to touch into some deep sense of well-being, something that feels good and feels right inside, and to know that it's there. And maybe first it's just a little spark or seed, but to know it's there and then be the caretaker of it. to use that as a reference point. And the stronger it is, the more important reference point it becomes. In this way, that it leads to a heightened sensitivity to what diminishes those beautiful qualities. Heightened sensitivity to what even does violence to them. Heightened sensitivity to how we lose touch with it, how we mistrust it, how we close it down, all kinds of things that, you know, that we do. And that heightened sensitivity and seeing the effect and what happens to this inner life gives us a reference point for how to live so we don't do those things. So if life begins every moment fresh in a certain kind of way, and it all begins here with you, and you have some reference point inside of some quality of well-being, or some, maybe it's no well-being, but you know, you can feel the movements inside and how it affects you, what diminishes you, what closes things up, what opens, what frees, what brings peace or ease, sense of well-being a little bit, what direction it goes. Then as life begins fresh every moment, you can see, oh, if I do this, that's not for my welfare. If I do this, it's for my betterment. And then this vision, it starts here and travels out from here into the world. It gives us a reference point for how to be in the world as well. Not to be self-absorbed, but then we know that how we are in the world needs to be in harmony with this goodness that's inside. So generosity. Generosity can be spring naturally from the goodness from inside. It can be so natural or so that, as Adrian was talked about, there can be a sense that there is no giver, no receiver, and no gift. Generosity that's so simple and so natural that it doesn't feel like generosity, but it just feels, you know, just coming out of some goodness. So the second parami, the second of these perfections, is sila, which can be understood as integrity or virtue, ethics. In the teachings of the Buddha, it specifically refers to when he defines what sila is. He describes it by what you don't do. So it's virtuous abstentions. Maybe abstentions is not very popular, to abstain. But the alternative word was to call it restraint. And I think restraints is even worse. But the idea of what we don't do. So generosity is what we do in the world. And then abstain, sila, is what we abstain from doing. And if you have a reference point inside, where you really can sense, are sensitive to the effect of your speech, your actions are, then you know for yourself, this doesn't make any sense to go around intentionally harming. It doesn't make sense to intentionally lie or engage in sexual behavior that harms other people, or do, lying. Or it doesn't make any sense to get intoxicated or drink alcohol or take drugs because of the impact it has on this thing that we're discovering inside. And it's not that a moral question of ethics, but it's just a practical thing. If you put your hand on a hot stove, it's not an ethical thing, you pull your hand away. You don't put your hand there and then go look up a book on ethics and find out, you know, what are you supposed to do? You pull your hand away. So if a person has this inner reference point, then there's you get the message that, oh, this I'm touching a hot stove here, and you pull away from these behaviors without needing to be told that you should, or these are the Buddhist rules of ethics or something like that. And the second parami it has to do again with behavior, what we do in the world, but it has to do with the abstaining from causing harm as a way of supporting this inner life, as a way of being the custodian of our inner life. There's a story that I think is a little bit strange, but if you allow me to say it and be a little bit generous to the story, don't kind of try to squeeze the literal meaning out of it too much or something, or question it too much. You know, it's a fable. And there was a man named Angulimala who was a murderer at the time of the Buddha. And the Buddha went into the forest to find this man and was able to convert him from his evil ways, and he became monastic. And then he was, as a monk, he was traveling with the Buddha someplace, and they came across someone who was in great distress. And there was a idea in ancient India that if someone's made a statement which is true, there's power in truth. So make a truth statement, then it might help the person in distress somehow. And so the Buddha turned to Angulimala and said, can you make a statement, make a truth statement that you have never caused, you never harmed anybody in your life? And Angulimala turns to the Buddha kind of like, I imagine he had an expression of, I don't know, being perplexed or something. I can't say that. I killed all these people. And the Buddha said, no, your life began when you became ordained. The life in the Dharma. So he made the statement, since I started my life in the Dharma, I've harmed no one. And then the person who was in distress somehow became undistressed. So I tell you the story in that this idea of starting fresh, starting anew. You all made a commitment for the precepts at the opening of the retreat. I think there's a fair chance that you promised not to kill anyone. I think there's a fair chance you haven't since Sunday. That's pretty wonderful. Thank you. Congratulations. You can feel good about that. That can be a source, rather than just seeing, oh, that's what we do in retreats, and of course, it's a matter of fact, and, you know, it's not really part of my life, and I don't really care because, you know, I'm not going to kill anyone, and it's just a ritual we do, and, you know, just kind of blow it away. It's possible to appreciate that the commitment not to kill or to harm arises out of some place inside of you that's beautiful, that's precious, that's a treasure. It comes from a wisdom, a place of knowing inside, that not only do you do it not only because you don't want to harm someone else, but you don't want to harm yourself. You don't want to diminish. You're the custodian of this inner life. And we do a violence to ourselves when we intentionally harm others. I've known people who have been angry, sometimes for years, and when they realize they were harming themselves more than they were harming others, the person they were angry with, they started to realize, well, maybe the cost-benefit analysis is not quite right here. And so they started giving it up. So, you know, you did this five precepts, and you started anew, in a sense, a few days ago. Maybe that can be your truth statement for these days you're here. And maybe that can feed and nourish something, support something. It can help you tap into a sense of goodness that's here. it was a surprise to me when I went to practice in Thailand that in Thailand, people were joyful or happy when they were ethical. I had never heard of such an idea growing up. And I grew up with the idea somehow that, you know, I was basically ethical, but maybe mostly from a lack of imagination. But, you know, and I kind of, there's people who are ethical were kind of, I think the expression was goody two-shoes, which I don't have no idea what it means, but it was like not good to be that kind of person. I kind of didn't think so highly of it. And then I came to Thailand, and people had this joy about being ethical. And I was kind of like, well, I had to think about that a little bit. And then my experience in Thailand was I sat a 10-week retreat, like you're doing 1 week here. And lo and behold, one of the big turning points for me on that retreat was to tap into a sense of purity inside, kind of ethical purity that I had never tasted before. And it just felt precious. It felt like, you know, something very, very valuable, really beautiful. And then that's why they're so happy, these people, about their ethics, their certain joy. So we start over again all the time. And how we start over can be without the burden of the always bringing along the past. There's something, it's possible to start fresh in some areas, in some ways, to some degree. And at least for these days here, you've been practicing sila. You've been practicing, intentionally or unintentionally, you've been practicing these abstentions. Abstaining from killing or harming, abstaining from taking what's not given, abstaining from, well, usually for lay people, sexual misconduct, but Adrian said, sexual activity. No one would have come if that was the advertisement. Come to an abstain from sexual activity retreat. And then abstaining from lying, or at least, you know, intentionally lying, and abstaining from intoxication, from alcohol and recreational drugs. So the way that this is a virtue, a parami, this ethical qualities, this ethical behavior, is when it's tied to something valuable and important within ourselves. It's not a parami just because you follow a rule, because you're a good Buddhist and this is what you're supposed to do. It's a parami when it's really infused with our sense of compassion, infused with the treasures of freedom, or the path to those things. Being ethical supports the discovery of these beautiful qualities inside, this resource, this reference point inside, that once you have that reference point, it can be the guiding light for a life. With those reference points, it becomes kind of sets the standard or sets the direction or sets the gives the understanding of how to live in the world with ease, with peace, with generosity, with compassion. The third parami is renunciation. And that's the usual English translation. And I happen to love this word, maybe I've come to love it. I've been told, there's rumors, that it's a very unpopular word in some parts of Western Buddhism. And there's a rumor, I never noticed this at all, but there's some people whose idea is that some of these Western lay teachers don't want to talk about renunciation because it's kind of a downer. But I think I love it, this topic of renunciation. To me, it's like a big word. Maybe my associations to the English language are strange. But I associate it with majesty. It's like a majestic word, renunciation, because it's like The word literally from Latin means to announce again. It's like making a commitment again or more fully to a path in life. And I think it comes out of, you know, probably comes out of Christianity and maybe monasticism's idea that you publicly announce that you are stepping away from certain behaviors in the world, worldly behavior. But the image I have of someone who renounces is they're standing strongly and firmly on both feet, upright, tall, and they're making a confident statement of renunciation. This I'm giving up. This I'm no longer committed to. It's like an expression of strength to do it. So it's less about what we're giving up than what we gain in the giving up. So if we give up looking for everyone else to approve of us, what do we gain? If we give up needing to always be the smartest person in the room and proving it, what do we gain? If we give up complaining, imagine standing there tall and strong and announcing to the world, I renounce complaining. That would be pretty cool. What do you gain from that? So there's a whole series of many, many things that people can renounce in a healthy way, appropriate way. But what is gained? Maybe there's less fear. Maybe there's more peace. Maybe there's less agitation. Maybe there's access to some of these virtues inside in a bigger way. Maybe there's access to more wisdom, to compassion, to love, to empathy, a sense of well-being, happiness. So this letting go process that Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis on letting go, and so many different words for letting go. It's possible to look upon this letting go as a focus. You're letting go because we know it's for our betterment. We're better because of it. And if we don't know that we're better in letting go, we don't know it's for our betterment, there's no obligation to let go, no obligation to renounce. We're not supposed to be diminished by renunciation, but in a certain way enhanced by it. And there might be letting go of many of the things of the world that, you know, live a simpler life. But again, it's not to be diminished, but to be more, have more of something else. And we get a sense of that from the Pali word for renunciation, which is nekamma. And one of the primary etymologies of the word that people say comes from, it means going forth. And sometimes it's described in the suttas as going forth from the dusty household life. And so you have to kind of, not all household lives are dusty, but it's kind of like going from a claustrophobic place to a place that's expansive. And the image I have for this is, you might, you know, maybe you have enjoy your relatives a lot. So you gather all your relatives together in a one-room cabin in the mountains and then get snowed in for the winter. And there's no showers, there's, you know, just like you're there, you can't leave for, you know, months. And it's just you and the relatives. And finally, the snow melts and you can finally open the door and go out into the open air and the pastures, the green pastures and things. And it just feels so good to go out. You feel so expansive and open. It feels so free to step out. So this idea of going forth in the Pali word nekamma has a little bit that connotation. That what we gain, there's a stepping forth, an opening to something. What do we gain when we simplify our life? What do we gain when we're no longer claustrophobic with our desires and our attachments and our fears and our conceits? What do we step out into? Can there be spaciousness and peace and ease and a sense of security because we're not holding on to so much? So one of the virtues is renunciation, letting go. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to let go. And so here on the retreat, we are practicing letting go, maybe in small ways. Some of you have probably big ways. To come on a retreat like this and not speak is a huge deal for some people. And to let go enough to be able to settle into it in a nice way might take a lot of letting go. You have to let go of having, you know, maybe, you know, having the kind of food that you prefer, and that eat the food that's offered. You let go into a schedule that's here. All kinds of things that, you know, maybe it's not your preference, but you left it behind when you left home. But more subtly and perhaps more powerfully is we sit quietly and focus attention on the breathing, and the mind wanders off. And mind wanders off. And it can be quite amazing to start noticing the strong power of thought and the preoccupation with thought and the whirlpool of thinking that we get caught in. And then we let go of our thoughts to come back to our breathing. And we do it over and over and over again. And maybe what's important is not how often you wander off, but it matters how often you come back. And the more often you come back, more often you let go of your concern with your thoughts and come back, you're training yourself, training the muscle of letting go. And that's a muscle which maybe ideally would become strong for when you most need it. There might come a day where you really, it's important for you to let go, but you haven't trained yourself, you haven't learned, you haven't identified where and how and what comes up as you let go. And so maybe you can let go. You know how. I've known people who come to the last days of their life and they let go. And it was quite impressive to be with them. And I've known people who come to the last days of their life and wouldn't let go. And that was impressive in a different way. I've known people who have had accidents, you know, physical accidents, gotten injured, and they knew how to let go into the new life that came with. And I've known people who didn't know how to let go, and they were holding on to all kinds of ideas and clinging and expectations and demands and wishes and all kinds of things. You don't know what this life is going to ask us to let go of as things change. If that muscle has been developed, maybe you're ready to do it in a wise way. So each of those little movements where you let go of a thought is a training. You're kind of like in the letting go gym. And then to get more value out of this letting go, if you have a sense of something that's better, then as we let go of the thoughts, to let go into the breathing, let go into presence, let go into a sense of being here and awake and in a way that hopefully feels good, has more substance, has more reality, has more texture, has more life in it. then whatever it is that we're thinking and preoccupied by. And so it's not a matter of just letting go of thoughts because we shouldn't be thinking. It becomes letting go of thoughts because A, we see that some of those thoughts that we have are not for our own betterment. They actually harm us. One leading cause for depression in this country is how people think, how people ruminate, meaning they think the same thing over and over and over again. And it can have a huge impact on people's psyche to say the same thing to oneself over and over again, and the weight of it, and how discouraging it can be to say things which are mean or say things which are, you know, that undermines our well-being. And then to feel, so A, to see how these thoughts are not for our betterment, and B, to know that there's something good here, something valuable here, that can be a home or a resting place or something of value. And part of the negotiation of Buddhist practice, and you know, it's not easy, and part of the debate, part of the wrestling that people will have with this practice is a struggle to really trust what they begin discovering inside. Trusting that place of not clinging. Trusting that place of not resisting. Trusting the place where we don't want more things. Trusting that place that we don't, you know, are not criticizing. Because is it okay to be that way? Is it okay not to be avaricious and want? Is it okay not to be judging and judgmental? Is it okay not to be critical? Is it okay not to kind of, you know, hold on to a sense of self, self-image? And so this, is it okay? And on one hand, there's another possibility. On the other hand, it's not familiar. Our society sometimes tells us that we need to hold on, we need to be ambitious, we need to do this and that. And so there can be this struggle inside. And that can be a noble struggle. It's a nice thing. If you have this reference point inside that knows something that's of value and important and special. It's not a useful struggle if you don't have that inner reference point. If you just read, you know, some book or something, or I say it's a good idea. But it should be your own. It's in you. And then, you know, experimenting, exploring, what is it like to come from this place inside? There were times in my practice where I wrestled. One of the big wrestling points was at some point I had the wisdom understanding that it was time to let go of my self-image that I was so carefully guarding and protecting and projecting and behaving in such a way to try to get everyone else to participate in the self-image. And this was exhausting. And I knew it was time to let go of it, but I couldn't. It was just too frightening. I felt literally that I was standing on the edge of an abyss, and if I let go of it, I was going to step over and fall in this big hole. So, you know, I was up against this area of challenge. But I came up to that place because of what happened in this meditation practice we're doing here. I came and saw and felt, experienced what it's like to not live with this self-image, self-identity preoccupation that I had. And I felt the ease, the peace, the well-being, the joy that was possible without it. And I could feel how having it diminished me. Didn't mean that it was easy to let go of, but then that became the task. How do I renounce this? How do I let go of this that's no longer serving me, and I know something that's better. How, in letting go, can I let go into that which is quite wonderful, special? So renunciation, letting go. The other day, Adrian listed the six paramitas, and one of the ones that is not in the, which is in the sixth list, which is not in the ten, is meditation or jhana, dhyana. And so to, in our tradition, we have these ten without the meditation jhana thing. They say, well, that's because it's in the renunciation parami. That a lot of deep meditation has to do with letting go. A certain kind of deep letting go, letting go, letting go. And I like to think of it as not just about letting go, but as I'm saying, been saying, it's also about letting go into, dropping into something. I don't know if it's a good image for you, but I have this early childhood good memories that have to do with hanging on to the underside, you know, of a pool diving board. And, you know, I wasn't going to jump in, but I'd hang, and then I would just let go. But then as I let go, I'd let go into the wonderful pool. You know, so this idea of letting go into something, and that was, for me, it was a nice, nice image. So here we are. Just this moment. And what can you let go of? That's extra. That's not just this moment. What can you let go of that takes you away from this moment? That keeps you at a distance from it? And is there a way of letting go into this moment that connects you with something that's precious, to a wealth, to treasure, something that's luminous or clear or true? It's not always luminous and wonderful what's here that we let go into. Sometimes we let go into, letting go into some of the big challenges of our lives, our struggles and difficult emotions and all kinds of things. But there's a way of letting go into it and being with it that feels true. Like we're, oh, this is true to be connected to it. It's true to really see it and know it. Not because we're going to be caught in it, but we're here. Oh. This is what's here. It's uncomfortable, but it's true. And that can feel precious. The contact with truth, with what's actually happening. To let go in such a way that the conversations in the mind become quieter. To let go in such a way that the commentary and judgments recede. To let go in such a way that the discursive mind feels simpler and easier and peaceful. That I can take a break, a little vacation. To let go of preoccupations with the past and the future, so that something, so that we're letting go into the only place where the lived life can be experienced, which is here and now. The living experience of life is only here, not in the past, not in the future. I know that each of you is beautiful. Each of you is precious and valuable, a treasure. It's in you. And may you touch that. And in touching it, may you feel more at ease as you sit here breathing and walking and being at our retreat. Be a good custodian of your inner life. So let's take a moment to gather together into the meditation mode.